distinguished guests, ladies and gentlemen, the President of the United States.
Thank you. President Alcofa and distinguished guests and friends, this is the third time I visited here, and I was thinking on the way over about the first two occasions. The last time I was here, I was governor of Georgia, and I came up to make a preliminary announcement of my candidacy for president. I went back to Atlanta that night and made the actual announcement. I think the headline was National Press Club Invites Unknown Governor to Speak. And the first time I came, I was also governor of Georgia, and actually the news story was that I was trying to get an appointment with John Ehrlichman's assistant, and I might report that I was unsuccessful in doing so. Today, in order to leave as much time for questions as possible, I'd like to make a brief but a very important statement about one of the most important aspects of government. I came to Washington with a promise and the obligation to rebuild the faith of the American people in our government. We want a government that can be trusted, not feared, that will be efficient, not mired in its own red tape. A government that will respond to the needs of the American people and not be preoccupied with needs of its own. Taxpayers who work hard for their money want to see it spent wisely. We all want a government that's worthy of confidence and respect. That is what reorganization is all about. We have no illusions that this task will be easy. Our government and its bureaucracy have evolved over many generations, and the work of reform cannot be completed in a single year or a single administration of a president. But we have begun. We have already adopted zero-based budgeting in all the agencies of government. We've cut the burden of paperwork on the public and reduced excessive government regulation, replacing it with free market competition. At OSHA and in other federal agencies, we are discarding obsolete regulations and rewriting rules in plain and understandable English. We've cut significantly the number of employees in the executive office of the president and abolished hundreds of unneeded advisory committees. But all that is not enough. The single most important step that we can take is a thoroughgoing reform of the civil service system. Civil service reform will be the centerpiece of government reorganization during my term of office. I've seen it firsthand, the frustration among those who work within the bureaucracy. No one is more concerned at the inability of government to deliver on its promises than the worker who is trying to do a good job. Most civil service employees perform with spirit and integrity. Nevertheless, there is still a widespread criticism of federal government performance. The public suspects that there are too many government workers, that they are underworked, overpaid, and insulated from the consequences of incompetence. Such sweeping criticisms are unfair to dedicated federal workers who are conscientiously trying to do their best. But we have to recognize that the only way to restore public confidence in the vast majority who do work well is to deal effectively and firmly with those who do not. The two complaints most often heard against this present system are that federal employees have too little protection against political abuse and too much protection against legitimate assessment of performance and skills. These charges sound contradictory, but both of them happen to be true. And the system that perpetuates them needs to be changed. For the past 7 months, a task force of more than 100 career civil servants has analyzed the civil service, explored its weaknesses and strengths, and suggested how it can be improved. Their judgments are reflected in the message that I will send to the Congress today. Some of the leading congressional reorganizers are here with me, and I would say, in gratitude to them, that there's been an unprecedented close working relationship between the Congress, its staff members, and the White House, the Office of Management and Budget, and others. Today, I'd like to outline these proposals and explain the reasoning behind them. They represent the most sweeping reform of the civil service system since it was created nearly 100 years ago. The simple concept of a merit system has grown into a tangled web of complicated rules and regulations. Managers are weakened in their ability to reward the best and most talented people and to fire those few who are unwilling to work. The sad fact is that it is easier to promote and to transfer incompetent employees than it is to get rid of them. It may take as long as 3 years merely to fire someone for just cause, and at the same time, the protection of legitimate rights is costly and time-consuming for the employee. You cannot run a farm that way. You cannot run a factory that way, and you cannot run a government that way. We've lost sight of the original purpose, which was to reward merit. More than 99% of all federal employees get a so-called merit rating. And last year, out of about 2 million employees, only 226 people lost their jobs for incompetence or inefficiency. That's about 0.01%. So my first proposition is this. There is not enough merit in the merit system. There is inadequate motivation because we have too few rewards for excellence and too few penalties for unsatisfactory work. We must encourage better performance in ways that are used widely and effectively already throughout private industry in our country. Top federal employees are ready and willing to respond to the risks and rewards of competitive life, and public service will be healthier when they have that chance. We must strike a new balance that preserves the merit principle while giving managers the incentive and the authority in hiring and to manage. We propose to do this first by creating a senior executive service whose 9,200 members will be available to serve wherever in government they are most needed. Participation in this effort will be voluntary. They will be eligible for annual bonuses for superior performance and can be moved from the senior executive service back to their previous civil service status for poor performance. I'll also ask the Congress to authorize the use of incentive pay for the 72,000 federal managers and supervisors in grades GS-13 through GS-15, which is a far more attractive and sensible acknowledgement of merit than the silver water carafes and the thicker carpets that pass for recognition today. They will no longer receive automatic step increases in pay without regard for performance. Another proposal which will improve managerial excellence is a speedier and a fairer disciplinary system, which will create a climate in which managers may discharge non-performing employees, using due process, of course, with reasonable assurance that their judgment, if valid, will prevail. At the same time, employees will receive a more rapid hearing for their own grievances. The procedures that exist to protect employee rights are absolutely essential. But employee appeals must now go through the Civil Service Commission, which has a built-in conflict of interest by serving simultaneously as rulemaker, prosecutor, judge, and employee advocate. So my second proposition is employees still have too little protection for their rights. I propose to divide the present Civil Service Commission into two bodies, an Office of Personnel Management to improve the productivity and performance of federal workers, and a Merit Protection Board to stand watch against merit abuses and to resolve the appeals which are brought by employees. I will also propose an office of special counsel to investigate merit violations and to protect the so-called whistleblowers who expose gross management errors and abuses. And finally, I propose the creation of a federal labor relations authority to remedy unfair labor practices within the government, much as the National Labor Relations Board does now in private industry. In addition, we will continue to work with Congress and the federal employees to develop legislation which, while recognizing the special requirements of the federal government, will improve federal labor practices. One other serious defect remains. That's a network of rules governing hiring, staffing, and tenure. We should give each agency more control over its own hiring, rather than the Civil Service Commission, which now takes as long as 6 or 8 months merely to fill important positions. Current rules, which often impede the hiring of qualified women, minorities, and the handicapped by giving veterans a lifetime advantage under civil service laws, must be changed. Far beyond the benefits that are provided under other veterans programs, which are designed legitimately to ease the readjustment from military back to civilian life. Therefore, we propose to reduce the preferential advantage given to non-disabled veterans to a 10-year period and to end this preference altogether for senior military officers who retire with pension benefits after a full military career. At the same time, we will strengthen provisions to ensure that disabled veterans and those who served during and since Vietnam are fully protected under the civil service laws. Let me be straightforward about the implications of all this. Our proposals will mean less job security only for incompetent federal employees, but conscientious civil servants will benefit from a change that recognizes and rewards good performance. Our proposals deal with the major changes that must now be made. By enacting them, we will make employment in the civil service more challenging, more profitable, more productive, and a more gratifying career. But the greatest beneficiaries will be the American people, who can expect to see a more competent and efficient and responsive government, one that is worthy of the people it was created to serve. Thank you very much.
Oddly enough, we have questions that don't relate to what your speech was about, Mr. President. The first question, which has been in the news much lately, is this comes from James Carey of the Copley News Service. What are you going to do about the deteriorating dollar and the basic cause of its collapse, soaring foreign oil imports? And a related question by Joseph Slevin of the Slevin Economic Report, saying that European financial officials say the U.S. should defend the dollar more vigorously.
Thank you, Frank. I spent a lot of time studying about the American dollar, its value in international monetary markets. The causes for the recent deterioration as it relates to other major currencies. I can say with complete assurance that the basic principles of monetary values are not being adequately assessed on the current international monetary markets. There are three that I would like to mention specifically. First of all, the attractiveness of investment in our own country compared to other nations is rapidly increasing. One of the reasons is the higher interest rates that can be paid on investments in our country. Another one is the rapidly increasing consumption of oil that occurred during 1977. This caused us a great deal of concern. In 1978, we will not have that circumstance. Present trends and future projections show that at the worst, we'll have a leveling off of imports of foreign oil, one of the major causes of legitimate deterioration in the quality of the dollar. And the other point is the degree with which American economic recovery or growth compares to potential purchases of our own goods. In this last year, our own rate of growth was about 3% greater than the average of our major trading partners. That difference will be substantially less in 1978. We'll still have adequate growth, but our major trading partners will have better growth than they had last year. So these three basic causes in 1977 for some lowering in the dollar's value will be much better in 1978. We do move aggressively and adequately to prevent disorderly market circumstances when that need is obvious to us. We'll continue to do that. But my own belief is that these basic principles that assess the legitimate value of the dollar have not been adequately observed recently. My guess is that in the future, over a longer period of time, what I've just told you will be observed and the dollar will remain in good shape.
We have a number of questions on coal, this one from Richard Stroud of the Christian Science Monitor. Do you feel that the administration waited too long before intervening in the coal strike?
No.
On another subject. Recent public opinion polls, this from Judy Woodruff of NBC, show a continuing decline in the rating people give you for your job performance as president. How concerned are you that your administration is perhaps developing a reputation for fumbling and ineptitude because of incidents like the Marston firing, or for a failure to exert leadership because of the stalemate on the energy bill?
I might say that we have had to deal and have decided to deal with some long-standing, very difficult, controversial issues that in some instances had not been adequately addressed by my predecessors. I say that without criticism. But obviously, we needed a comprehensive energy policy years ago. No one has ever proposed it to the Congress from the White House until last April the 20th. This needs to be acted upon immediately by the Congress. The House completed its action last August. We still have not been able to break a deadlock in the Senate energy committees. Hard work is going on that right now. It's one of the contributing causes to the lowered value of the dollar overseas. I think if we can get a resolution of the natural gas issue alone in the conference committees, immediately there would be a restoration of confidence in our nation's will to act on a difficult question and our competence to deal with those complicated issues. Obviously, we have addressed other measures that are difficult as well. We've had remarkable success, I think, in the last year in holding down the increase in inflation, in reducing substantially the unemployment rate, in having a carefully predicted increase in our gross national product. We've got a good record on budget preparation, cooperation with the House and the Senate. And we have learned in this last year, there is some criticism that we acted too late in the coal strike and too early by others. My own deep commitment is that whenever the collective bargaining system can function, government ought to let it function. And I think had we precipitately imposed our will in the coal strike deliberations, that effort would have been counterproductive. I don't know what the miners will do this weekend. I hope they'll vote affirmatively on the negotiated settlement. But I think it was not an exhibition of irresoluteness on our part. It was a carefully balanced judgment about what we should do. We have addressed some questions on the Middle East that in the past had too long been ignored, trying to bring about a comprehensive settlement there. This is a very difficult, complicated issue over which we don't have control. We have encouraged direct negotiations with Israel and the major Arab countries, we've been successful in seeing that occur because of the action by foreign leaders between Begin and Sadat, something that was hoped for generations, or for at least for decades. We've seen a recognition of Israel's right to exist by Egypt, and progress has been made. Obviously, not yet have we been successful. So I think that the polls show that my own personal popularity is very high. The assessment of how successful our administration has been is disappointing, but it's a partnership between us and Congress, between us and the nations in the Middle East, between us and the coal miners and the coal operators. And government doesn't have the unilateral autocratic control over some of these very difficult issues. So I'm concerned that there has not been a resolution of all these major confrontations and disputes, but we're making good progress, and I'm not disappointed at the progress that we have made. I'm certainly not disappointed at our willingness to tackle issues that have historically been difficult to resolve.
You mentioned your predecessors. This question relates to one of them. It's from Paul Healy of the New York News. Mr. President, 2 years ago, President Ford said from this podium that there would be no emergency federal financial aid to New York City, prompting the famous Daily News headline, "Drop Ford to City, Drop Dead." Yet President Ford later supported a loan program to the city that seems more generous than the one outlined on Capitol Hill today by Secretary Blumenthal. What is your response to this?
Well, in the first place, as you know, the Congress moved well to prevent a bankruptcy of the New York City government. We've had very close personal consultations with the mayor and other city officials, the banks, the unions, the governor, and the congressional delegation here in Washington. Yesterday afternoon, I talked to the mayor, Mayor Koch, to the governor, Governor Kerry, and to Senator Moynihan, yesterday and this morning to Secretary of Treasury, Mike Blumenthal. I think the proposal that has been put forward is basically adequate. It's obviously not everything that the New York City officials would want. We believe in sharing the responsibility between the federal government with the guaranteed loans and those other entities that I described, local lending institutions, the Union's Trust Fund, the city government, and the state government. This does provide a long-range guarantee of loans. It's not month by month or even year by year. Secretary Blumenthal recommended a 15-year period during which we would guarantee up to $2 billion in loans. I think it's a very reasonable and also a very adequate proposal, and it's one that we are not presenting to the Congress idly. We intend to fight for it. And I know that there's a great deal of concern in the Congress that this might be a proposal that's too generous. I think it's adequate, not overly generous, and one that's worthy of our support, and it will get our support.
Later this month, you'll be meeting with Prime Minister Menachem Begin from Israel. Dick Ryan of the Detroit News asks, what do you hope to achieve during your meetings with the Prime Minister?
This will be my third meeting with Prime Minister Begin since he's been the leader of Israel. In addition, I communicate with him fairly frequently by personal letter, by diplomatic message, and on occasion by telephone. And both our own Secretary of State and other officials and his Secretary of State and other officials come here frequently. Defense Minister Weissman will be here shortly to consult with me and with the Secretary of Defense, Secretary of State, and others. We are looking for some common ground on which the Egyptians, the Israelis, the Jordanians, the residents of the West Bank, and other areas can agree. This is a difficult and sensitive question. As you know, the Gaza Strip has had an affiliation in the past with Egypt, the West Bank with Jordan, both now occupied by Israel. And we hope to search out at the top level of government some resolution of the differences on specifics relating to the Sinai and also on a statement of principles relating to the occupied territories off the West Bank and the Gaza Strip, hoping at that time that Egypt and the Jordanians and the Palestinian Arabs who live in the West Bank Gaza Strip would be satisfied to conclude perhaps some agreements and to proceed with further negotiations leading to an ultimate resolution of the issue based on United Nations Resolution 242. One of the crucial elements of any progress in the Middle East is a cleaving to the commitment that UN 242 is a basis for continued negotiations and a solution. The abandonment of that would put us back many months or years. So this is what I hope to accomplish with Prime Minister Begin, to frankly discuss with him my previous agreements and discussions with President Sadat, to encourage direct negotiations to be resumed, and to search out common ground based on advice given to me by Secretary of State Vance and also by Mr. Atherton on the latest possible language changes that might be necessary to let Egypt and Israel agree. So this is what I hope to accomplish, and I believe the personal discussions will be good. I would much prefer that the personal discussions be carried on between Sadat and Begin. But in the absence of that possibility at this moment, we hope to restore it and act as an intermediary.
There are several questions here related to the civil service reorganization. This is a combined question from Mary McGrory of the Washington Star and Mark Gooden of the Houston Post. The first part is, what sort of protection will the Office of Special Counsel provide for whistleblowers? And the other part is that Frank Snapp, the ex-CIA agent, is the most famous whistleblower of all, writing a book exposing incompetence and treachery after a report to the Inspector General produced no results. You're prosecuting him. How does this encourage whistleblowing?
Well, I'd like to respond to those completely unbiased questions. I don't look on Frank Snapp as one of the greatest whistleblowers of all times. He signed voluntarily a contract, later confirmed this agreement with the director of the CIA that before his book was published, that it would be examined to assure there were no revelations of secret material. And I have not read the book, don't know the substance of it. I don't believe that he's revealed anything that would lead to an improvement in our security apparatus or the protection of Americans' civil rights. But the Attorney General has decided that when a contract is signed, that it ought to be honored. If everyone who came into the CIA or other highly secret organizations in government felt free to resign because of a dispute or to retire at the end of satisfactory service and then write a book revealing our nation's utmost secrets, it would be very devastating to our nation's ability to protect ourselves in peace or war and to negotiate on a confidential and successful basis with other government leaders. So I believe that this is important as a distinction to be drawn. The special counsel will be there, independent from me, to protect through the courts if necessary those who are legitimate whistleblowers and who do point out violations of ethics, or those who, through serious error, hurt our country. And this is a function that's not presently extant. I think it will be a step in the right direction, and there will be presentation after investigation to both the public and, if necessary, to the mechanism by which employees' rights are protected, and on an appeal basis to the courts themselves.
Mr. President, this from Warren Rogers of the Trib of New York. With the Soviets active now in the Horn of Africa and with other strains in U.S.-Soviet relations, what hope do you have for early resumption of SALT talks?
The SALT talks have never been discontinued or delayed. They are ongoing now, and the Soviet involvement in the Horn has not interrupted that process. We do not initiate any government policy that is a linkage between the Soviet involvement in Ethiopia, Somali dispute, on the one hand, and SALT, or the Comprehensive Test Ban negotiations, on the other. Obviously, any negotiation, if concluded successfully at the executive level, would have to be ratified by the Congress, who would be heavily influenced by opinion of the American people. And the fact that the Soviets have overarmed to the teeth the Somalians, who then used Soviet weapons to invade Ethiopia, and now are overarming Ethiopia and directing their military effort, has caused a threat to peace in the Horn area of Africa. We have added our own importunities for a peaceful resolution and our own caution comments to the Soviets. They have assured me directly through Foreign Minister Gromyko that the Ethiopians would not cross the Somali border. We have sent a delegation to meet with President Mengistu, who assured me personally that they would not cross the Somali border. We have three hopes there that we trust and certainly hope that the Soviets will honor. One is a Somalian withdrawal from the territories which they occupy in eastern Ethiopia, in the Ogaden area. Secondly, a removal from Ethiopia of Cuban and Soviet troops. Third, a lessening of the tensions that exist between those countries and an honoring of the sometimes arbitrarily drawn international boundaries in Africa. And we would hope that the OAU, the Organization of African Unity, would become more successful in their efforts to resolve this dispute in a peaceful way. But at this time, Somalia is the invading nation. We have refused to send any weapons into that area or permit third countries who bought weapons from us to transfer them into that area. And I think our policy is completely accurate. The Soviets violating of these principles would be a cause of concern to me, would lessen the confidence of the American people in the word and peaceful intentions of the Soviet Union, would make it more difficult to ratify a SALT agreement or a comprehensive test ban agreement if concluded, and therefore the two are linked because of actions by the Soviet. We don't initiate the linkage.
Mr. President, we have several questions related to the Braniff Airways low-cost service between Dallas and London, one from Ross Mark of the Daily Express of London and another from Roy Bodie of the Dallas Times Herald. First of all, have you received a recommendation from the CAB for retaliatory action, and do you plan to take such action against a British carrier? And secondly, do you believe that the British government is abiding by its commitments in the Bermuda II airline agreements?
I have not received a recommendation from the CAB at this moment. When the recommendation gets to me, I, by law, will have to act and will act immediately. I don't know enough about the issue, the details of the British government ruling, to know whether or not they violated the agreement that was concluded this past year. My guess is, knowing the British, that they have not violated the agreement specifically. But as you know, an agreement can't be that detailed to anticipate every individual ruling that will be concluded by the CAB on our side or its equivalent agency on the British side. I don't know much about the issue yet, but if there is a violation, we would express our concern directly to the Prime Minister Callaghan. And when the CAB gives me a report and a recommendation, the chances are that I would honor it. We have had notable success in 1977 in increasing competition, particularly in international routes for air carriers. We have encouraged the additional competition of American airlines in this area as well. We hope to get the Congress to act on substantial deregulation in the airline industry within our country. I believe that we've made notable success already, and we have withstood a tremendous pressure from the British to have more government protection, which would be contrary to competition, in the agreement that we reached last year.
At the risk of showing favoritism, I'll ask a question from Jack Cole of the Milwaukee Journal. Would you support legislation to reduce Social Security payroll taxes by transferring the hospital care and disability portions of the program to funding by general treasury funds?
I don't think that 1978 is a time to further or modify in any substantial way the Social Security law, which was just passed this past year. Our own recommendation to Congress in 1977 did involve some transfer of funds and some use of general funds from the Treasury if the unemployment rate and or the inflation rate caused excessive drains on the reserve funds. I think that Congress was very courageous and acted properly in increasing Social Security payments into the funds to maintain the integrity of the system itself. Had they not acted, we would be in a crisis stage right now. We are convinced that the recommendations that I have made to the Congress to lower income taxes will compensate in almost every instance for the increase in Social Security tax payments that were passed by a previous administration and also increased this past year. So I don't think 1978 is a proper time to change it. I think that the principles of partial use of general funds under certain circumstances, a settlement that we did advocate, and transfer of monies from one fund to another is a principle which we would also espouse when the time comes, if it does, for additional changes in the Social Security law. That's what we recommended last year.
Mr. President, we thank you very much for appearing here today, and I have one final question for you for which I'll take full responsibility. In view of the 33-page so-called Jordan Report, is there any truth to the rumor that you're planning a White House conference on etiquette in singles bars?
This is a matter that had not previously come to my attention. Until just before this press conference. I've known Hamilton Jordan a long time, and I have discounted this story because they've said that he was drinking amaretto and cream. And a White House conference is certainly worthy of consideration. My own personal advice would be that perhaps in the future, Hamilton might substitute peaches for the amaretto.
The President is shaking hands with the members of the press club and those guests who are at the head table, Congressman Nix of the House Civil Service Committee, Mrs. Catherine Graham, the publisher of the Washington Post. He's being escorted out by Joseph Slevin, whom I incorrectly identified earlier as being with the Wall Street Journal. He's with the Slevin Economic Report. The last answer that the President gave that caused such a laugh in the room was, of course, about the cause celebre here in Washington of 2 weeks ago when allegedly, reportedly, Hamilton Jordan, who is one of the closest advisors to the president, it is said, either spat or spilled his drink on a neighboring woman at a local singles bar. And about 3 days later, the White House responded with a 33-page defense of Mr. Jordan's conduct. And the question today, put by Frank Ockerver, was the president going to consider a White House conference on etiquette at singles bars? And he got a good laugh out of that one. He defended Mr. Jordan, of course, but recommended he switch from amaretto and cream to peaches and cream. Just briefly again, the president today announced his well-publicized but long-awaited reform of the Civil Service Commission system, and he called it the centerpiece of his proposal for government reorganization and reform. That reform, incidentally, is complicated, but would in effect bring in the fear of firing and the lure of a reward to the government service. It would create a senior service of top-level executives who would no longer get automatic pay raises, but would get up to 20% bonus increases based on competence. Those top officials could be transferred from one department to another. If they chose not to go into the senior service system, they would remain in the lower grades. Below that senior system would be a middle management group, which could get up to 12% bonus increases for competence. And the whole firing and demotion and promotion system below that would become much easier. The Civil Service Commission would be abolished. It would be replaced by two groups, one to administer the new system and the other to protect the workers who remain under civil service. On the question and answer period, the president said he was disappointed by his administration showing in the polls, but said they were addressing some very tough questions. He also said that the Russian overarming, as he called it, overarming to the teeth of the Somalis and the Ethiopians, was a threat to peace in Africa.